coming up on Boston Public Radio. And the winner, or in this case, the loser, is Boston. Actually, Boston, Worcester, and Springfield, three of the four most accident-prone driving cities in all of America. With your help, we'll try to find out why. Then Charlie Sennett of Global Post and Ground Truth, who's reported from some of the most dangerous places on Earth, will join us to talk about two news people he knows who suffered very different fates, James Foley and Theo Curtis.
And then we'll ask you, should the United States pay ransom to possibly save these lives or not? Harvard Business School's Nancy Kane tells us amazing tales of healthcare workers risking their lives and losing their lives to care for Ebola patients. And our TV guru Bob Thompson reviews last night's Emmys and tackles today's most asked questions. What's wrong with Seth Meyers and John Hamm? Nominated and cruelly denied not once, twice, but a dozen times. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Hey, Jim.
Hey there. You know, everybody in the building is surprised we made it to work 2 days in a row after being off for what seems like
Herculean
forever.
Effort here.
In any case, today Allstate released its annual Best Driving Report. Boston, Worcester, Springfield rank among the most accident-prone cities in the whole country. So does this have to do with drivers' attitudes? Is it a function of how our roads are designed? Does it have to do with the number of drivers on the road? Joining us on the line to decode what accident-prone means and why Bay State drivers carry this diagnosis is Michael Nodler. He's the director of UMass Safe, and he's a professor at the Department of Civil Engineering at UMass Amherst. Michael Nodler, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning, or good afternoon. How are you today?
We're excellent.
Terrific,
thank you.
Michael. Thank you for being here. So, Michael, this is pretty bad here for us city drivers, Boston, Worcester, Springfield. What are we doing wrong?
Yeah, well, let me shed a little bit of positive news first, right? So one thing that Massachusetts has actually done quite well, we've been at or near the safest state in the country in terms of the overall fatality rate. So even though there might be a crash proneness or accident proneness problem here, we've relatively been at or near the top of the charts in terms of fatality rates. There's probably a number of factors that go into that ranking, and I heard the report this morning, had a chance to dig into the report a little bit, but I think you touched on some of them in the open there. Part of it is, you know, being some of the older cities in the country, the layouts that we have of many of our cities aren't like the grids of many more modern cities. Lots of one-way streets, dead ends, some challenging layouts that can be confusing. You couple that with the fact that we have a high college population here in the Commonwealth, and each of the three cities that you mentioned are really known as college towns. So lots of new faces coming in on a regular basis, lots of folks coming in that are younger in age, which, you know, also contributes to crashes. Factor in the winter weather, which we have here in the Northeast, that, you know, some of the other major urban areas in the study don't have. Tie that together with our suburban network. So we have, you know, heavy suburban networks, which adds a lot more vehicles to the roadways. And then I guess we'll cast a little bit of blame here. You've got the Northeast in general, we're known for our aggressive attitudes, and that certainly transfers over into our driving habits. I think when you look around the country, there's a lot more laid-back lifestyle that carries over into their driving, and we certainly see some of that here in Massachusetts.
Yeah, it is always shocking if you go someplace like California, people actually stop for pedestrians in the crosswalks. But Michael Nodler, I'm just going to ask you, no, it's unusual, they don't do it here. Jim and I are sort of obsessed with the elderly driving issue. Massachusetts is one of the states in America where you can take your driver's test at 16 and a half and then never take a driver's test again, and people that are, and some people can drive well into their older years, but some people, one of my favorite stories is a few August ago, according to State Senator Michael Brian Joyce, whoops, an elderly driver called the cops, and he said he was stuck in this snowbank, and the cops are thinking, snowbank, it's the middle of August, and they go down to get the elderly driver, and he's in fact in a sand trap and a golf course
yeah,
on the Cape. So do we have any idea how if this fact, the elderly driving thing, factors in, or do they not break it down that much?
We certainly break it down by ages and virtually by any variable that you might imagine we would look at. Elderly drivers tend to get a bad rap, I think, in part because of some of the crashes and incidents like the one you're describing that tend to be a little bit unlike many of the other crashes, so they tend to be a little bit more higher profile, perhaps. On a per-mile basis, older drivers actually tend to be somewhat safer than the majority of other ages. One other reason that they tend to be a little bit overrepresented is when we look at the fatality rates, they're overrepresented because of their frailty.
Yeah.
You know, if an 18-year-old is in a crash and an 85-year-old is in that same crash, you know, the injury sustained by the 85-year-old might be more significant.
Yeah, but when you say by per mile driven, they drive, they're more safe, but they drive far fewer miles. So, I mean, that has to be factored in, too. But I want to get back to this description, your analysis, Michael Nodler, of why Massachusetts, three major cities here. And by the way, there are 200 urban areas that are rated by Allstate. This is not like 15 cities. We are first, second, and fourth worst in the country out of 200.
Yeah.
I lived in New York for 15 years. Other than the fact that there are grids, which are wonderful, and stoplights that are timed, so you could drive from upper Manhattan, for example, to lower Manhattan without ever stopping most times. Every negative thing you said, and then some, from weather to congestion to dangerous driving to speed in cities, applies. And they're 40 places up the list, or 40-some places up the list. So how does New York get to be this outlier here? Does that not surprise you?
No, so one of the other things that happens in New York is because of the grid system and because of the structure, there's a little bit more of a reliance or an ability to accommodate bicycles, pedestrians, and public transportation. Mm. And so it makes it, you know, the accommodation of public transportation in a grid system is far easier than the accommodation of public transportation in a city like a Boston or a Worcester or Springfield for that matter. So that might be one. The other thing, too, and this I don't know offhand, but I think the other part of it here is there's a little bit less of a disincentive for reporting a crash to your insurance company in Massachusetts than there may be in other states. And so because we're not penalized for reporting, we are penalized for reporting it to our insurance company, but that penalty is less so than other states, that some crashes in other states, people try not to report to their insurance company out of fear for some of those penalties. And so that might be factoring into this as well.
Let me jump on one more thing you just said. I'm going to do a little self-promotion. I just wrote a piece about the intersection of bikes and cars in the Sunday Globe magazine.
It was a brilliant piece.
Thank you very much, Marjorie. And by the way, while Boston Bicycling Magazine used to rate Boston as one of the worst bicycling cities, we're now actually moving up to near the top. You said New York accommodates bicycles better. Is that part of the problem in these Massachusetts cities, is we haven't gotten to the point of enough bicycle friendliness, and that contributes to the accident situation, or no?
No, I certainly think we're getting there, and Boston, you know, is now moving up the rankings significantly. You know, probably second behind only, you know, Portland or some of the other cities out on the West Coast. I think MassDOT has put a priority and an emphasis on accommodating pedestrians and bicycles. And I think you're starting to see a lot more of the infrastructure that's associated with keeping them safe on the roadways being put into place. And I think that will translate into just only positive effect for commuting capabilities here in the Bay State.
We're talking with Professor Michael Nodler, who's also director of UMass Safe. Michael, you've mentioned a couple of things already that we could do better. Are there any other solutions that you haven't mentioned you think might make a difference in our less than stellar record here?
Yeah, I'll mention one other one. And this one, you know, I'm by no means trying to touch off any sort of controversy. One other thing to keep in mind is, by and large, we have one of the lowest gas taxes in the country. And as a result of that, gas is relatively cheaper here compared to some other states. And so we don't have that disincentive to hop out of our automobile and hop onto public transportation or walk or bike. And so, you know, you mentioned the example of New York a minute ago. The gas prices in New York are higher. And so, you know, people have that disincentive to drive, which doesn't exist here.
Well, let me tell you, by the time they raise the gas tax in Massachusetts, we're going to have self-driving cars, Professor. Let me tell you.
I'm always afraid to mention that. It's actually pretty fun. I teach a seminar, The Societal Impacts of Gasoline Prices, here at UMass. And no shortage of opinions during the course of the class. And it's really interesting when you look at the breakdown of the gas prices and the like. And that's a conversation for another day, perhaps. But
one exception, if I can just interrupt. We get email saying, Jim, we just raised the gas tax. I'm aware we raised it by a modest amount. And the question on the ballot, by the way, which voters will decide in November, is whether or not the inflation adjustment on that should stand. But I'm sorry to interrupt you, Michael.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And certainly something that, you know, I enjoyed debating and talking about on a regular occurrence. Massachusetts and MassDOT in particular is really committed to improving safety here in Massachusetts. And one of the, when I was speaking with your producer earlier today, one of the activities that I mentioned is the Strategic Highway Safety Plan.
What's that?
It's developed here in Massachusetts, and it's an ongoing process of identifying emphasis areas associated with priorities in improving transportation safety here in Massachusetts. Some of the things like improving older driver safety, younger driver safety, vulnerable road users, you know, commercial vehicles. So all of these issues are routinely addressed by a group of stakeholders that come from different facets of the profession. So it's not just the engineers, it's the educators, the engineers, you know, the public officials all getting together and talking about different countermeasures and improvements that can be done. I would encourage folks to read the Strategic Highway Safety Plan, provide their input and feedback, and I know it's something we're helping out with here at the university as well.
Don't read it while you're driving, by the way. What's that again?
I really look forward to the outcome of, you know, as we start to see the Strategic Highway Safety Plan initiatives implemented, I think it will go a long way towards improving safety.
Yeah, I just realized you would know this, and I can't remember. We have Rich Davey, the Secretary of Transportation, on the show quite regularly. Does he even own a car? I can't remember. I know he's a big T rider. Does he own a car? Do you know, Michael?
That I don't know.
I can't remember, yeah. Hey, Michael Nodler, thank you for both your research and your input on this. We really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Michael. Michael is the director of the UMass SAFE, and he's a professor at the Department of Civil Engineering at UMass Amherst. We're opening up the lines now to you guys. Jim is going to tell us about his extensive investigative reporting he did. You know, I can't believe this, but I actually forgot you had a piece in the Globe magazine
Sunday,
this week.
Sunday, yes, so it was this Sunday.
You can fill us in on that, and
I'd
people can look
to.
It up online.
Thank you.
Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Do these rankings ring true to you? I think they do to me. Do you feel more...
It's one thing to be bad. We are three of the four worst cities out of 200 in the country.
What are you talking about? You've been driving here for years and years.
I know that.
Do people stop at red lights? No, they don't. Do people stop at... I mean, people are always going through red lights in Massachusetts. You always have to look both ways. Do people stop at stop signs? No, they don't. People are always making U-turns in the middle of the road. We are hazardous around here. And then you had a few mishaps. I mean, Jim is the king of rear-ending people.
No, I'm not the king.
A couple. He's been busy texting when he rolled right into people.
I don't text and drive anymore.
Anyway,
either.
Our number is 877-301-8970. Do you feel more accident-prone in Massachusetts than in other states? Have you gotten in more accidents here than in other parts of the United States? And it is absolutely true what Michael said. You're always stunned when you go elsewhere, not maybe New York City or maybe not Philadelphia, but if you go like to the Midwest or you go to California, you're in a crosswalk and people stop. How often do people stop in crosswalks?
What are you talking about?
By the way, San Francisco. When I had like a cast in my leg, people stopped for me in the crosswalk.
First of all, Los Angeles, nobody stops for anything. And number two.
San Francisco, they do.
Excuse me. San Francisco is right ahead of us on the worst list of most accident-prone communities.
They may be bad, but they stop in crosswalks.
So we want to know a couple of things. One, if you've lived elsewhere, how does it compare to here? Two, were you surprised Marjorie wasn't, that we rank at the bottom? Three out of four Massachusetts major cities, the worst out of 200 in the whole United States. And if you have solutions, by the way, in that piece I read in the Globe, wrote for the Globe, which Marjorie chose not to read, one of the things I talk about is the solution for the whole bike car wars, which, by the way, the Boston is moving in this direction big time, to the credit of Nicole Friedman from whatever the biking thing is called, and former Olympic cyclist, by the way, and Marty Walsh and Tom Menino, the cycle tracks. You know what a cycle track is? Where there's a physical separation between the bicycles and the cars. We already have two of them. We have one on Mount Vernon in Dorchester, and we have one right by the studio here on whatever that's called, Western Ave or something like that, in Brighton, where there are automobiles driving, then there are automobiles parked, and then on the other side of the parked cars is where the bicycles go. So the physical separation is the cars. It's a fabulous idea.
Michael just emailed from Roxbury. He says, Boston has the most arrogant, inconsiderate, uneducated drivers. Simple laws of the road, like who has the right of way on a street with a crosswalk but no light or stop signs? Answer? Pedestrians. But 90% of Massachusetts drivers do not know this.
By the way, Nicole Freeman is Boston Bikes. Paul on our Facebook page says, I blame the design of the roadways. The poor signage is also a contributor. Great point. Merges require quick moves against heavy traffic to cross in order to get into the correct lanes. That's also a great point, particularly in the big dig in the
tunnel.
You know
what else is a big thing here?
What's that?
Rotaries.
Yeah. Only place in the country. I believe we're the only state in the country that still has what our, your GPS calls roundabouts.
Roundabouts, that's correct.
But they are rotaries.
I wish I had John Cleese in my GPS.
I used to in my old one.
Yeah, can you still get them?
Went on the, no, not on the one.
But he berate you?
I moved to another company.
For making a wrong turn.
He does. He does berate you, and he's the voice. Monty Python, for those who don't recall. 877-301-8970. How bad do you think we are? We're number 1, 2, and 4 on the worst list, Worcester, Boston, and Springfield. And do you have any solutions? Let's start in Worcester with Dan. Dan, one of the worst, actually the worst city in the United States. Hey there, Dan.
Good morning, Margie and Jim.
Hey there.
Glad to have you guys back.
Thank you.
I called a couple times last week, and I was actually calling in, and I heard myself on the radio again. It's pretty interesting.
There you go.
It was allegedly the best of, otherwise known as reruns of our time. Thanks, Dan. What's up?
Exactly. Listen, I have one thing to say about the fight with Boston and other areas. The people like myself who pay the use of road taxes, gasoline taxes, the excise taxes, all of the fees and what have you, for the privilege of owning a vehicle in the state and driving it over the roads, I have a proclivity to go towards the people like myself. As far as the bicycles are concerned, what we should do to alleviate this problem is people should be allowed in vehicles to run over a few bicyclists once in a while, get
Dan,
a little bit of a break on your insurance rate, and you would see the bicycling issue go down.
The bicycling issue. Okay, Dan. I think that's enough
out
of you.
Dan
Thank
doesn't
you.
Like the spandex, I guess.
By the way, and also I should say, cyclists understandably do not have much of a sense of humor about this because there have been some
really terrible
accidents. By the way, it's not only the obligation of cyclists and drivers to be more respectful, leaders have got to fund things like these cycle tracks. It really is a great solution.
You're not separated from the bicyclists. There's no room in too many Boston streets for the bicyclists and the cars. There's just not. Here is a great email from Laura in Cambridge. She's absolutely right. Massachusetts poor driver's ed has to be a contributing factor in the accident rate. She talks about growing
schools,
up in Illinois. It is awful. You basically, when you go to have a driver's test with your kids, when you did it with your kids, I did it with mine, it's like they drive a block and a half, turn two corners, and they get their driver's license.
Well, I had to pay. Did you pay for your kid? I paid $600 a kid
she's making the
to
point,
take a driver's course.
Well, I didn't pay that much. But anyway, she said she grew up in Illinois and had a full, free high school quarter of an excellent driving ed experience. And the test to get the license was difficult. They don't even take these kids out into the highway. Mm. They don't even take them out to
I mean, from
Route
schools
9.
You're talking about.
No, I mean when they do their driver's
in
test.
In schools. Oh, driver's test.
The driver's test
yes.
is a great big joke. And you know, they have you parallel park, but you're not parallel parking between two cars. Mm. You're parallel parking with only one car. She did between two cars?
Yeah, she did.
Well, she's unusual. Did she parallel park okay?
Next question. Okay. The second time she did.
Did she get her license?
The first time?
Really? They denied her license?
And it was
license?
Because of the parallel parking, actually, yes.
Wow.
Why don't you talk to her about that? It really made her happy. Sam, you're in Cambridge. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for the call, Sam. Hi. Sam.
Hi.
Hi.
This is Kim.
Oh, Kim, I'm sorry. Hi, Kim.
Hey, no, that's okay. Hey, I've lived here 3 years.
Yeah.
I've been in 5 car accidents.
That's great, Kim.
Three rear ends, one little tap on my left fender, and I got slammed pretty bad in a rotary.
Wait
and
a second, you've been the victims? You've been the victims of these 5 as opposed to the
And I've been in 2 cycling accidents on Mass Ave in Arlington, both of them. But I'm still here, I'm still upright, life is good, and I have a philosophy about why there aren't so many fatal accidents here.
Why?
So many cars crammed on the road, you can only go so fast. So you can't really get going fast enough to do a really good rollover where you get killed.
By the way, I don't think that's a preposterous position. I think that is part. The congestion essentially leads to more crashes but fewer fatalities, which fits what Michael Nodler just told us.
Now, Kim, were you rear-ended by a very tall man with gray hair in a Toyota Highlander? No?
I did not rear-end Kim.
No.
I did not.
Young kids looking at their phones or GPS or stupid crap.
Yeah.
Like that.
Kim, thanks for the call.
That's what happened to me when I was in my car accident that recently. Don't you remember? The girl was texting.
Oh, yeah, you do,
yes. She ran the red light and plowed into my car. And luckily for me, I mean, it was in a big car, and she wasn't, and it was a bad situation.
By the way, Marjorie, I have been in 2 minor rear-ending things that may have been my fault. And do you remember the woman from the second one has actually called both of our radio shows?
Yeah, that's
called
right.
in because I wasn't paying. I agreed to pay her
that's
as opposed to
submit
it to insurance.
Well, there's a
and
long...
she called on the radio to ask why, and they let her through why I hadn't written her the check yet. Hello?
There's a long and checkered history here.
It's not checkered.
You were in court.
I paid up.
You were in court.
No, that was the third incident. That was another incident. I didn't crash into anybody there.
Oh, yeah. But you drove the wrong way down Morrissey Boulevard.
Maybe I did. I can't remember. I think I was found not guilty of that charge.
No, I think you were found
guilty,
actually.
I don't remember. Marjorie was a hostile witness, literally had to be called as a hostile witness by my lawyer at the thing, which was embarrassing.
You wanted me to lie.
No, I did not. Sue in the car, you were next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about Allstate rating Boston, Springfield, and Worcester as three of the worst driving accident cities in America. Hi, Sue.
Hi, I had to call. It's my first time I've called. I love you guys.
Thank you.
But I have to tell you, I'm a New Yorker like your previous caller. I had my very first accident here. A cab almost took my door off when I opened the door. He came right up and almost hit my door. But I have to tell you, I met my husband here. He scares the crap out of me every time I get in the car with him. He's a horrible driver. And we're constantly arguing because he's just so aggressive. The tailgating is terrible. And just one more thing, use your blinker, people.
By the way, Sue, while you're explaining the facts, you're not going to the cause. It can't just be geography. What is it that makes, in your estimation, and by the way, the survey tends to agree with you, New York drivers are far less accident prone, even though they're pretty high in the ratings, bad in the ratings too, than New Englanders. What's that about?
I don't know. I find people here more angry, more road rage. I mean, I lived in the city, you know, in New York City, and I never encountered the driving conditions.
Sue, wait a second. Sue, I lived in New York City for 15 years, and I'm not exaggerating when I say the following. I never in 15 years took a cab ride where I had my eyes open for more than 1 second because it was so terrifying. Am I wrong or am I right?
No, they're bad. I'm not saying they're great drivers there, but there is a marked difference between driving there and driving here. And I've driven in Boston. I live sort of and drive a lot in your neck of the woods, Marjorie.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
My favorite move I never saw before I moved here was the creep into the lane to make a left-hand turn. Yeah.
That's right.
That's my favorite move. I never saw that. And every time I see it, I'm continually amazed at the creative driving techniques that people come up with here to creep into or, you know, turn. And the other thing I have to say, nobody ever wants to stop. Nobody ever wants to stop. They're rolling through stop signs, rolling through intersections. If I'm walking on the street, I will literally have a car come with an inch of hitting me because the oncoming car doesn't want to stop.
Sue, if we told you that you could keep talking till the end of the show at 2 o'clock,
yeah,
you could do it, couldn't you?
Yep.
A lot of pent-up anger here, Sue.
Sue, tell your husband to go take a ride on the Massachusetts Turnpike, because I was driving home from someplace on the Turnpike just a couple of days ago, and they had these signs, keep calm, drive on. A takeoff on that thing, keep calm and carry on, that British thing, the expression they used during the war, and the World War II, I mean. And I think it was World War II anyway. And now they have this on the Turnpike, so you're supposed to, like, slow down. I didn't see anybody slowing down, but that was the thing. Keep calm, drive on.
Hey, Sue, that was a great first call. Do it again soon, please. 877-301-8970. Let's try to squeeze in one more if we can, Marjorie. Paula, you're in Newton. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Paula.
Jim, I adore you, and I saw you once in Whole Foods, and you're fabulous.
Thank you.
Was he at the hot bar at Whole Foods?
Yes, he was.
I knew it.
You know, I have to say, I'm from California, and I'm terrified of driving here. It's like I got pulled over by a police officer, and he just started laughing at me because I was like, "That's speeding. That's not even original." And the thing about breakdown lanes, you guys drive in the breakdown. You guys can drive in the breakdown lane.
I know. I hate that, by the way.
What do you do if you're, like, broken down? Do you tell your computer not to break down during that time?
It's all over.
Amen.
That's it.
By the way, we have to ask, and you know, you may, that's on, particularly on 128 you're talking about, right? Isn't that a 128-95?
You can do it on Route 3, too, in rush hour.
And by the way, when next time we have Rich Davian here, Secretary of Transportation, that's a great point, Paula. That is really a dangerous prospect. What do you do if you are broken down?
Go into the woods. You drive up the hill into the woods.
Hey, Paula, where are you from in California?
It can happen to you.
Where are you from in California?
I'm from Southern Cal, but I lived in Northern Cal, people are calm.
I do think they're more calm in Northern California. Absolutely. Well, I was stunned when I got to college. People actually stopped for pedestrians. I couldn't believe it.
You know, Paula, can you mention the hot bar? Can you imagine a day in the future where you can drive up to the hot bar?
A drive through?
Would that be incredible? What?
But, Jim, nobody would get to see your sexy body then.
Thank you so much. Very kind of you, Paula. Call anytime.
Pamela is emailed. She says she wants to stick up for Massachusetts drivers on one count. And this is a good point.
What's that?
The four-way stops. We've initiated a lot of these four-way stops. And she says we're actually good at taking turns on some of them.
What are you talking about? Everybody stops and then everybody goes at the exact same time.
You think so?
Yeah. What is the rule, Marjorie, on who should be the first? If there are four people at four stops on a corner, who is the, under state law, who is the person who's supposed to go first?
The first one was there.
I don't think that's the case.
Of course it is.
Is it the case?
Well, who else is supposed to go
first? How would
you
know who the first one there is?
Well, you notice who got there first, Jim. Yeah. That's how you notice. Okay, we're moving on from this.
We are.
Okay. Up next.
We really solved yet another problem. That's the beauty of these discussions, is it not?
Up next, we're going to talk with Charlie Sennett. He's the co-founder of Global Post and also heads up the Ground Truth Project. We're going to talk to him about the hostages who have been, in some cases, killed and in some cases released, and the issue of ransom for the release of these hostages. That's up next on 89.7 WGBH.
Back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And a week after the brutal killing of James Foley, another American held hostage in Syria has been freed. Freelance reporter Theo Curtis was freed by Al-Nusra Front. It's a Syrian rebel group. Is the stark comparison between Foley and Curtis's fate say more about the respective captors or more about how the negotiations were handled? Here is in Studio 3 to examine what it means to handle these kinds of kidnappings in this new world order is a guy who is reported from some of the most dangerous places on earth, Charlie Sennett. Charlie's a GBH news analyst where he also runs Ground Truth Project. And as you know, he's the co-founder of Global Post. Charlie, it's good to see you.
Thanks, Jim.
Hey, Charlie, before we get to that, there's some breaking news about a deal reached on a long-term Gaza ceasefire. What mm-hmm. happened?
Yeah. So what we're hearing is from right now is from the Palestinian side, from the Hamas operatives in Cairo are saying that an agreement has been reached for a ceasefire. That would come with some conditions, which is that the rockets will stop from Gaza if there is some relief for the travel restrictions that have been imposed on Gaza for a very long time. There is no border they can cross. There is no way for goods to come in or to come out apart from those tunnels, which played such an important role in also bringing in weapons.
So has Israel agreed to that condition?
So we have not heard from Israel, but what we have heard from are the negotiators on one side saying that a long-term ceasefire has been reached. If those are the terms, it would seem those might be acceptable to Israel to allow for free flow of the border for travel, to lift those travel restrictions, and to ease the fishing restrictions so that the Gazan fishing ships can get back out and fish. But nothing's going to happen, according to the very rough parameters that are coming out on this, unless this ceasefire holds for a month while talks lead toward the much more long-term assurances that Israel will need that Gaza will demilitarize and the longer-term assurances that the Palestinians in Gaza seek, which are that they will actually have the ability to have an airport and a seaport that is functioning so they can have a connection to the world. Because right now they are trapped, surrounded by barbed wire in a very crowded area that is now completely, many parts of it at least, have been reduced to rubble as a result of the Israeli airstrikes. So it's a hope. It's a prayer that maybe this is an opening towards some serious peace talks.
And you think it's a prayer and a hope, but you think, what do you think the possibilities are of that coming true?
I'm sad to say I've covered it too long to be very optimistic. I worry both sides are capable of returning very quickly if they perceive any violation of the very strict terms that will be laid out. But we've only heard from the Palestinian side in Cairo. We haven't heard from the Israeli side whether or not they accept these terms or whether this is really going forward. So the reports are premature.
Well, let's get back to James Foley, the American held hostage, of course, who was killed brutally, beheaded. He worked for your company, Global Post, and Phil Balboni, who co-founded Global Post with you, has said that there was a ransom offer, a ransom request made, and that you guys, Global Post, were actually trying to raise the money. What happened?
Yeah. It's hard to know where to begin. I haven't seen you guys since terrible news. So I guess the first thing is just to say, you know, GBH has been so strong in its coverage and in staying to the facts, but in also being very aware of the need to offer condolences to an amazing local family, the Foleys, whose faith and strength is miraculous. I mean, I was with them at the funeral on Sunday when we got the news that Theo Curtis, the Cambridge, Massachusetts resident, was released. That came first in a phone call to Diane and John Foley, the parents of Jim.
From Nancy Curtis, the mother.
From Nancy Curtis. Before it went out to the media, she wanted them to know. And she wanted them to know that while they're celebrating, they're just as equally continuing to mourn with them about Jim. Mm. Real bonds formed here with these families and the families of the other hostages whose lives hang in the balance. So this is a long journey with us, with the Foleys and with Jim, and with having to delve into just how perilous and dangerous a time it is to be a reporter in many parts of the world right now.
So the ransom thing that I heard Phil Balboni speak about, who, by the way, was my former boss at NACN, the guy that hired me years ago, and again, as Marjorie said, co-founded Global Post with you, there was a ransom request. And the odd part of this is we all know quite well the United States' position is the United States as a country does not deal with ransoms.
Correct.
But apparently it is perfectly legal for individuals, for businesses, for whatever, to come up with a ransom. And from what I heard from Phil on the radio or on television, there was an effort by both your company in conjunction with the family to raise some amount of money to try to satisfy the captors of Foley. Is that, do I have that accurately?
I think you have most of it accurately. I'm not so certain, you're better on the legal aspects than I am, that it is perfectly legal to explore payment to a terrorist organization for ransom. I think that there are questions under Homeland Security Act that would raise serious questions about anyone who would funnel money to a terrorist organization like ISIS, which is unquestionably a terrorist organization, and the perverse incentives that could create and the ways in which you would be funding their operation to take potentially more people hostage and to try to grow their operations to do bombings and suicide bombings and killings and to take on the U.S. in every way it can, including possibly coming right here.
But you did try to raise the money. That's accurate.
Well, a couple things I would say with you are, one, Jim Foley was our guy. Jim Foley was someone who we loved working with, someone who we admired and who did great work for us. Jim Foley was a freelancer who went into Syria on his own and not as an assignment, but then we took work from him. Mm-hmm. And the thing I think I admire about the way Phil Balboni, as CEO, handled this was that because he was there and we took some work, we're going to treat him as if he was our family. And we're going to do everything we can with all of the resources we could put together to hire a private investigator, to be sure that we looked into every aspect we could. And our CEO was dedicated to that, as was the whole of Global Post. I got to say that. We all pulled every oar we could in the water to try to get him home, whether that was a correspondent who got a little bit of information in the field and shared it. Everything we could funneled into this effort. It was Phil Balboni who controlled that entire effort and those details and those facts and any negotiations or discussions of negotiations that would have gone on. So I want to be careful to say the facts matter. They're very sensitive. We have to be careful. But I would say this. The U.S. position is you absolutely do not pay ransom to a terrorist organization. That is a perfectly understandable position. It has foresight of thinking long term. And it's an important policy. It makes sense. The U.S. and the U.K. uphold that. The Foley family's position, as would be my position as a father, and anyone who has a son or a daughter who is being held for ransom is you pay, you save their life. You do whatever it takes to save their lives. So these two vying, very understandable approaches were in play in this. And it was never, as my understanding has it, that Global Post would make a decision what to do apart from supporting the Foley family in anything they wanted to do and in coordination with the State Department and the legal authorities, understanding this is a criminal act. And this is a criminal investigation that needs to go on. And we have to be very respectful of the laws. So
the criminal law, I'm sorry, just so I understand, Charlie, because when you said before, I know more about the law than you do, I know nothing about the law on this international thing. Is the criminal act the attempt to raise money to pay a ransom?
No,
you're talking about the criminal act
by
ISIS and the captors. That's what you're talking about, the latter.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. The criminal act being the hostage taking and the ransom and the death threat on his head if it was not paid. That's a criminal act by ISIS, and that's what I meant.
I'm sorry.
I was just going to ask you, we're talking with Charlie Sennett from Global Post. You mentioned getting private investigators and so forth to go try to find James Foley. Was there any awareness at all on your part or anybody close to you of this mission to attempt to rescue these guys that did not go well, of course, because they'd been moved? Did you guys have an inkling that was happening?
We did not.
Okay.
The Foley family did not know.
They didn't know either.
There were some tough things said in frustration from those who support Jim Foley. It came from several different perspectives, but people were wondering, where was the United States on this? We had information that was not precise, but as accurate as could be gleaned through the investigation of where those hostages were being held. Was it acted upon in real time? Did the United States do everything it could? We don't have the answers to that yet. And I think the Foley family would be the first to say they're not going there right now. They're going to wait to get answers, but I think they deserve answers. And I think the whole community of journalism and the whole community of the United States deserves more answers about what was done and when. I think the reaction was in response to some tough questioning about, did you do enough? They wanted to share that, yes, an effort was made and it failed. And I'd question again, even that is a bit of a bumbling. I mean, should they have said that publicly? Should they have briefed the Foley family privately? And I don't know. Look, this is one of the greatest, most difficult moral questions of our time, which is, how do you save a life? What is a life worth? How do you do that? How do you deal with these terrorists who are like a death cult when they're holding someone you love and you just want to bring them home? What bigger question? But do I have the answers? I don't.
We're talking to Charlie Sennett. And by the way, since we started this conversation with Charlie 10 minutes ago, the Associated Press and Reuters are now reporting that Israel has accepted
the terms of this agreement with Hamas. That's really important and good news.
Now, let me stay on this whole issue of the United States policy being not to engage in a ransom. I have to say that I find it a distinction without a difference. Why is it not a ransom to offer up humans in return for the release of Sergeant Bergdahl? But it is not a violation of our policy to give dollars, meaning humans are okay as a ransom, but dollars as a ransom are not okay? What's the difference between Bergdahl and Foley?
I think there is a distinction, and I'll tell you about that. But someone who is pretty smart on the issue of terrorism and who is also sort of very, very much been holding court on the porch of the Chilmark store on Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts, is Alan Dershowitz. Alan Dershowitz has been the sort of the voice of knowledge on that porch for a lot of people who are very smart and play roles in government and play roles in supporting people in government. And he's held court on this. And he and I got into a big conversation over a cup of coffee on the porch. Dershowitz, civil rights fighter, legal mind, expert, and smart on terrorism, says, look, the Israelis say we will never negotiate with terrorists. And as Dershowitz pointed out, they do, because they do these human swaps. And they also enter into ceasefire negotiations in Cairo, even if they're indirect talks with Hamas, which is, from the Israeli perspective, very much a terrorist organization.
Yes.
So we live in a time of disproportionate war. We live in a complex time where the challenges we face in counterterrorism are extraordinary and complex, and the equations are going to have to change and shift. And I would say there's a qualitative difference in offering human beings who may have been in prison for decades already in exchange for a living human being like the soldier who the Israelis wanted to free. And they released, if you remember, 1,200 prisoners in exchange for one Israeli soldier who had been held by the Palestinian Islamic militants. That exchange might seem extraordinary, but it also saved a life. And I admire Israel for the value of that life. I think the math is extraordinary.
Yeah, but why do you think? But that doesn't explain, Charlie. Why do you think? I understand the facts. Why do you think that it is different to trade humans than it is to trade dollars? I don't get it.
Well, I think the dollars are a more definitive and crass implementation of handing the opportunity to that terrorist organization to do the work it wants to continue
on. Make money.
You may have faith in the human beings who've been in prison that they will never go back to doing that terrorism. So you want to put faith in humanity by saying, when you release them, you guys better never do this again, or we'll find you, we will track you down, and we will bring you back to this prison, or you will be dispatched somewhere else, as I am sure the Israelis would tell them. And I think that is a shot at humanity in a way that giving a terrorist organization and a death cult like ISIS is not. Giving them money is just too dark to ponder, I think.
We're talking with Charlie Sennett from Global Post. I want to ask you, because other countries are doing this, I guess France claims it isn't, but it seems like it really is, funneling money through employers of the hostage, Switzerland, Spain. Other countries do this ransom deal.
They do, and they have. We know that the journalists who were being held inside Syria by ISIS were coming out at an average price of $2.5 million.
Right. But I read this morning in preparation for your coming that France, who's paid a lot of money in ransom, even though they say they don't, also has an awful lot of French citizens being taken hostage. So it seems to be that there is an incentive that if we were going to pay that money, there'd be more Americans taken.
Marjorie, that is exactly right. I really think the equation here is that, hey, you're with the Foleys, this beautiful family. I would do anything. I would sell my own home. I would do anything I could to help them if that's what they wanted to do to save their son. I would do anything on this earth to help them. But the longer math, the equation, the perverse consequences you create when you hand over millions of dollars to a terrorist organization to carry out its goals, we have to think this through. So what I would say, it's a little bit journalistic. It's a little bit like not having an opinion. And I'm not copping out as much as I'm saying I don't know the answer, but I know we have to debate this. We have to pull ransom negotiations in the post-9/11 world out of the darkness and into the light of a fair consideration. Because right now, with France paying, saying they're not, the government turns a blind eye, and the news organizations or corporate organizations who have people held hostage pay, same with Spain, same with Belgium and other countries. We can't have that. That fragmented, fractured system weakens us all, and we can't have it. We have to hold tight. Those countries that care have to come up with some standard so that we can go forward confidently and not allow this situation to escalate. We've got to shut down hostage-taking as a funding mechanism for terrorism.
Yeah, by the way, Barack Obama and David Cameron then should organize the coalition of the unwilling, where the whole world subscribes. By the way, according to ISIS, one of our producers just pulled this up. In the last email to the Foley family, and you'd know if this is true or not, ISIS also requested specific prisoners for release exchange. Is that true?
It is true, although I think it is fair to say that in the timeline of these messages and these insane demands,
it was so late in the process.
We believe, and it is much more importantly, it is the security officials from the United States government believe that his death warrant had been written when the airstrikes began.
Understood.
And so the death cult that is ISIS was not to be negotiated with, and they weren't really open to it. So I don't think there is a sense of not meeting demands, because I think the demands just would have kept escalating, and we can have no faith that an organization like this ever would have lived up to it. They would have killed him anyway, potentially. And so I think the Foley family goes forward, I think, thinking and worrying and consumed with the other hostages who are there. And that is really the focus. How do we now get this debate going so that we can most effectively try to bring more of these hostages home safely? And what does it say about the world we live in where journalists are having to take these extraordinary risks? The danger they're in is escalating to a point where it's just horrific. And probably the most sobering thing for us at Global Post about Jim Foley is that we have a responsibility. We really inherit a deep, deep responsibility to do the right thing here by these families, by these correspondents, and to create a culture of safety, go for the big stories. You have to be there on the ground to get the stories that matter and can make a difference. And Foley did that. But you have to do it safely.
You know, I'm so glad you said that, because that's my last question, which I think is really important. We've had this discussion on the air and off the air with you, Charlie, is I greatly admire the work you've done, and I mean that sincerely, for decades. But I often think you're out of your mind to have put yourself in harm's way like you have repeatedly to get a story. But I admire it. I wouldn't have the courage to do it. Forget as a reporter, as an employer of reporters, like you are. You're a boss now, and I don't mean that in a pejorative way. How do you decide what is a risk not worth taking, even if the report – I mean, Foley's a perfect example. We don't have to talk only about Foley, where he had been kidnapped before. I mean, how do you decide when someone says to you or Phil Balboni, I am willing, and not only willing, I'm about to get on a plane to go to Syria, to go to a really scary place, and I'll be sending reports back. Do you ever say, by the way, obviously you can do what you want, we're not going to be a party to this because we've made an assessment, we just think it's too dangerous for you. Do you ever do that?
Of course we do. And the first thing you say to a correspondent who wants to go to one of these dangerous places is, don't go anywhere until we have a game plan. And we've approved, and we've looked at this, and we've studied it carefully, and we've managed the considerable risks. You know, I can understand how it's hard to see myself as a father of four, why I would go to Afghanistan, why I would go to Iraq, why I would get out on the front lines. I have worked this out in my own mind for years, and I still wonder sometimes what motivates me. And I know in somewhere deep that it really is about trying to add value to the knowledge and the understanding for our country at a time when we face great peril. And if you as a journalist can do that, or you can do what Foley did, which I think is slightly different. I think Foley wanted to bring an understanding of the humanity that suffers in war. And he wanted those stories. For me, it's been also about adding the value of 20 plus years of covering the Middle East, the rise of Al-Qaeda, all this stuff. And I think Foley had a calculus which was beautiful and true, which was he was pursuing in this almost priestly way, this truth, like he really had a calling. He wanted to get the truth, as ugly as it is of war, from the front lines back to America, back to the audience that happened to be Global Post. The biggest thing, though, is you have to plan up front and you have to think about it up front. And this is the Ground Truth Project, you know, which we're now here at WGBH. We have a field guide for Global Post correspondents, which is called Ground Truth. I wrote that field guide in 2009, right when we launched Global Post. The day we launched, the correspondents were given a field guide that tried to set standards and practices, that tried to look at the issue of not just standards and practices for fairness and how you report, but standards and practices for safety, that you have to have hostile environment training. You have to have first aid training, which Foley had. You have to look at every situation you go into with caution, because no assignment is worth anyone's life. And we have to, as news organizations, as we increasingly rely on freelancers, we have to have that culture. Creating the Ground Truth Project is inspired by precisely that. Our main mission at Ground Truth is to train the next generation of correspondents to do in-depth work that matters and to do it safely. And to be doing it here at GBH with Frontline, with Global Post, with you guys, this is huge. This is something that I feel like in the still sober reflection, in the immediate and emotional aftermath of Foley, these are the issues we really have to look forward to. Right now, we just got to care for the family.
Well, but hold on for a second.
Going forward, we got to think about these bigger questions.
Charlie Sennett, we're over already, but in 30 or so seconds, you've mentioned a few times the extraordinary parents of Foley.
Amazing.
Tell us quickly, what's that about? Why are they so amazing? What's extraordinary about them?
John and Diane Foley have an amazing faith. And their faith as Catholic family in God is extraordinary. Faith in God, I admire it in the darkest of hours. To see that faith come forward is something extraordinary. But in addition to that faith is a faith in their son. And they had faith that their son, Jim, had a calling to do work that matters. I know for a fact they wish he never went. I know for a fact they tried to talk him out of it. And I know for a fact they knew that they never could, that he was going back there to tell that story. And he's 40 years old. He was an experienced journalist. He was a talented journalist. He was a powerful storyteller. And his family on some level, and they're going to be working through this forever, so they may end up somewhere else down the road. But for right now, the thing that broke my heart, that made me really feel for them and be proud of what we do as journalists, was when they said, "We have never been prouder of our son." I mean, my God, the faith that is involved in that statement is just, it's extraordinary.
Charlie, great to see you as always.
Thank you for being with us today. Charlie Sennett is a WGBH news analyst. He runs the Ground Truth Project. You've heard him speaking about that, and he's the co-founder of Global Post. Charlie, great to talk to you.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to ask you about ransom. You've heard Charlie Sennett lay out the pros and cons. What do you think is the best way to handle a hostage situation? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, we've been talking to Charlie Sennett. You know, he heads up the Ground Truth Project, co-founder of Global Post. And obviously, we've been discussing the pros and cons of paying ransom for hostages in the wake of the horrific execution of James Foley from Global Post. And now we're going to ask you, we just have a few minutes for this. We want to get your take on this at 877-301-8897. You've heard the arguments against, which is that paying a ransom encourages more kidnapping and more potential violence, and not paying a ransom discourages it. And in fact, the United States, which doesn't pay at least cash ransoms, has had fewer of our people kidnapped, apparently, as a percentage of our population, than have some of these countries in Western Europe, which are paying a ransom. But two things I should say is, one, I hear what Charlie said. I don't understand the difference between giving humans for someone like that Israeli soldier or Sergeant Bergdahl as opposed to cash. I don't understand that distinction, and I think it is a distinction without a difference. And secondly, as he said, everybody, would you – I hate when people do what I'm about to do, but I will do it anyway. Even if one agrees with the policy, is there anybody who wouldn't want our government to do anything it possibly can to including – pay money to save someone you love?
Well,
I understand the thing in the abstract.
People. Absolutely. I mean, we have an email just from Mark who's saying, really, this is unclear to you. Paying ransom significantly increases the capacity of these death cults, as Senate calls them, in a way that a prisoner exchange fundamentally does not. How does it serve our interests?
That's just the statement. How?
Because they make millions and millions and millions of dollars. That's how.
Yeah, but I don't understand why. So the motivation is what the exchange does for them. Is that the notion?
Yes.
So we can negotiate with them and give them something that is not as valuable to them, meaning humans, who then – I mean, Charlie mentioned a couple of minutes ago, for example, my recollection of the prisoners who were exchanged for Bergdahl is there was a feeling they were going to go back to terrorism. But then, as Charlie said, the United States made some bold statement, if they return to their terrorist ways, we're going to go get them.
Well,
that's not very encouraging.
I think it absolutely incentivizes them to kidnap more people. I mean, France, as we mentioned before when Charlie was here, is paying more ransom than anybody else. And guess who's got the most hostages?
Right.
France.
So we should release people who we know have terrorist instincts. That's a better policy than paying. By the way, they're both fraught with huge numbers.
They're both fraught, but I would say it's a better policy.
Well, let me say one more thing about it. Then my attitude is that the comment I made about the coalition of the unwilling. If everybody in the world, if all civilized nations had the same policy we did, I'd be perfectly fine with it. But when we're the outlier, if the man or woman who is kidnapped happens to have been born in the United States, essentially we're signing a death sentence for them. If they're born in France or Switzerland, the likelihood is a check's going to be written to get them out.
So your position is the United States of America should write checks to ISIS to free hostages?
I think the answer is, unfortunately, I understand all the downsides. The answer is yes.
Well, I think that is not a good idea whatsoever, understanding all the and the other thing is, and we didn't ask Charlie this, but part of being a war correspondent is understanding that you could be all on your own in very,
sure,
very serious trouble in some of these places. And those are the issues you have to decide. I mean, in much less terrorized areas. I mean, people went to Iraq, you know, embedded with these soldiers in Iraq years ago. And
Charlie went to Iraq. Charlie went to Afghanistan.
Exactly.
Charlie went to Gaza. Charlie's been everywhere.
Of us, like me, said, I'm not going because
yeah, but Marjorie,
I'm
this notion that they're that voluntarily grown-up people go to decide to do things, they're providing a huge service for us, as Charlie said.
Yes, they are.
And I would suggest in return for shining light on things that light needs to be shown on, if that's the proper terminology, then we owe them something. Now, of course, you could say the United States did attempt to rescue them, according to what we learned after Jim Foley's death. But I have to say, and this is not a blame. I'm not doing a blame thing. I understand what the policy is, and I understand the motivations for it. But I don't buy it. Let's go to Andrea, New Hampshire. You're first on Boston Public Radio. Thanks so much for the call. Hi there.
Hello, you too. I love you guys.
Thank you kindly. Thank you.
Honestly, Jim, I agree with you. If you have to go there, okay, get them home. But what I don't understand, and with all due respect to journalism and your jobs and everything, what story do we really need to tell? We know the story already. I don't know about anyone else, but I'm tired of turning on radio stations and hearing all of this negative, horrendous stuff. Watching him die, horrendous. And I live, you know, I have friends in Rochester Police Department and everything. I don't understand what's the story. We know that they kill each other. We know we're trying to help. But all of us out here are helpless. And it's giving, I don't know, a sense of hopelessness.
But Andrea, let me interrupt you. Even though we agreed on the first part, information is critical to people in a democracy. I want to know what's going on in the world. So when my Congress or my president decides to do X or Y, I'm an informed citizen and can try to affect what people who represent me do or don't do. I mean, for example, we're sending drones for surveillance purposes over Syria. We may be dropping bombs in Syria in an attempt to get ISIS. Some of us worry that there's mission creep already in Iraq. The only reason we know that is because we've had really good reporting. And I understand your point of view, Andrea, but I have to say, I think more information is always the path to resolution or solutions. Andrea, though, thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
Let's go to Kevin in Brookline. Hi, Kevin. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Kevin.
Hey, very much so. And I love you guys as well. I just have to say that, we can't pay. You know, I feel like it opens up that door. And I hate the term slippery slope. I hate it. But it just opens up the door to them. And my second point is I also respect correspondents that go, and I feel like it's necessary and they're doing a job that needs to be done. Today with technology, aren't there other things we can do to track them? I mean, we chip our pets, we chip our kids, not that I would, but it's like, isn't there a way that, like, if you know you're going to a war spot, that it's like they embed something in your skin? I mean, it's so gross, but, I mean, we know where you are. It's like, and if you can do it with a poodle, right, you can do it with a reporter.
Yeah, you know, that might not be a bad idea,
I don't think
actually, when you think about it. It's not a bad idea. Because supposedly what happened with this botched attempt to rescue James Foley and other hostages was that they had been moved shortly after the United States forces got there. Now, that hasn't been verified by a lot of other sources, but that was one of the stories that they moved and they didn't know it. So with the chip, I guess they would, Kevin.
Kevin, thank you, though, for the call. Let me be clear here, by the way. I despite the position that I am embracing, and I have a feeling I speak for you too, is on the other side of this. It's not easy. This is not one of these simple topics that is debated on radio and television shows in this country. I understand there is a huge downside. I understand everything you're saying and that Charlie said and the callers have said. There's a huge downside. But there's another huge downside to not doing it, which is the end of the life of somebody like James Foley.
I guess I don't understand why this is difficult for you to see. The United States of America having a policy that we're going to pay millions
and millions of
dollars.
And we paid a ransom to get Sergeant Bergdahl out.
They were people. And there's a big difference, which you don't see.
Well, okay, so Marjorie, you say money. So it turns out we don't want to give them money. We'll give them human beings who will probably end up being terrorists again. That's as if it's as if we're cutting off their money source. You just said France, what have they paid? $74 million. It isn't like if we don't pay the money, there's not going to be $1 million a day or whatever the amount that has been estimated that's going into ISIS or ISIS. yells, Treasury. The reality is they're getting money from lots of other sources. So the fact that we're not paying it doesn't mean that they're not being financed.
Well, but the guess how much money – did you hear what Charlie Sinha said?
What?
He said the average is $2.5 million for these individual hostages. You know what they asked for Foley?
Yeah.
$132 million.
And
you know,
does that mean they wouldn't have taken – I have no idea. Would that mean they wouldn't have taken $4 million or $2
million?
Here's
the thing. If individual people and organizations like Global Post or ABC News or whoever it is want to raise money and they want to go – it cannot be the policy of the United States
why
of America.
Is it, but excuse me. Why is it okay, if I may, why is it okay – that the country's position, the United States position, by the way, Juliette Kayyem is formerly of Homeland Security.
We'll
she'll be
her.
With us tomorrow, and
we'll
she's a lawyer. We'll ask her what the law is for individuals. The policy of the United States is not to pay ransom, but you're endorsing, Marjorie, and you support that policy, but you endorse the effort by individuals and businesses to raise money in the United States to pay a ransom?
Because I do not think we want
to
say...
How's that consistent?
I don't think we want to say to a Mr. and Mrs. Foley, whoever else it is, we're going to arrest you or charge you criminally for raising money to rescue your son. That's
ridiculous. If Bill Gates's kid was kidnapped as a journalist, I don't even know if he has children, but he's kidnapped as a journalist, he can pay the 100 and some million or 4 million, whatever it is, but because the Foley family and the people at Global Post are not worth several billion dollars, they can't?
With due respect, Jim, I think that families could raise that kind of money. I think Americans are very generous
people.
They
attempted, excuse me, from what I understand, the Foleys and Global Post attempted to raise
the
money.
Well, and we don't know what happened. We don't know if the offer was rejected, it wasn't actually taken over, or whether, as Charlie Sinha said, the jig was up for James Foley when we began our bombing effort. Let us go. Our number again is 877-301-8970. Let's go now to Russ in Providence. Hi, Russ.
Hello, Russ.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I would like to relate just a quick story. Around 800 AD, there was an English king named Æthelred who was getting tired of Viking invasion. So he taxed his vassals and he raised 10,000 pounds of silver and he gave it to the Viking captain, the head of the guy who was in charge of the raids at the time, and said, "Leave us alone, please." And they said, "Sure, for 10,000 pounds of silver, we'll leave you alone." And next summer, every Viking ship was on the English shore because it was easy money. And all it does is it gives you a temporary break from the threat, but then it just comes back stronger. And as painful as it is for the family, I support the policy of not negotiating, at least with money. If we want to let some half-crippled guy who's been waterboarded in Abu Ghraib for the past 6 years out in exchange for an American, go for it. That guy's not a threat.
Russ, I have to say you're...
Dollars can buy a lot of stingers.
I understood. Your historical anecdote was actually great, and I wasn't aware of it. But the implication of your story, when you said the Vikings came back the next year, is that if the United States were to pay a financial ransom, that that's all we would do. We wouldn't be doing anything else to attempt to deal with the greater threat. And we are. I mean, the United States is actually doing, I don't know how successful it is, apparently, to some degree, the air bombing of ISIS has been at least pushed them back, if not caused them to disappear. So I'm not suggesting paying ransoms in conjunction with nothing. I'm saying pay ransoms in conjunction with a broader policy, but I know that it's a minority view. Russ, thank you for the call.
Here's an email from Colin. He says, government and society may have an obligation to recover soldiers like Bergdahl. That doesn't necessarily exist with civilians, including journalists.
And by the way, I should have said that. I'm glad. What's the name of the person?
Colin.
Colin, I'm glad you sent that, and I had forgotten about that. There are other people who know far more about this than I have made that distinction as well. I don't agree with it, but I guess there's some legitimacy there.
One more call?
Yeah.
No, we don't. We're out of time, actually. I'm sorry. We are out of time.
Thank you for your calls.
Yes, thank you very much for our calls. We're going to talk about this, as Jim said, more tomorrow with Juliette Kayyem, who is a security expert. Coming up, as aid workers and doctors flee parts of Africa to escape one of the most volatile public health cries in the region, who is taking charge? The power of leadership with a small L. That's what Harvard historian Nancy Kane is calling it. And that conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Last week, the head of Doctors Without Borders said that world leaders are doing almost zero to help countries. That's a quote, by the way, affected by the Ebola virus. which has turned out to be the worst outbreak in history, as I'm sure you know. If world leaders, the broad-shouldered men and women on the international stage, aren't pitching in, there's no disputing the local leaders are, or as Nancy Kane is calling them, leaders with a small L. She joins us now to talk about who is taking charge of this public health crisis. Ordinary people doing extraordinary things, I should say. Yeah. And then some. Nancy Kane is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, Ernest Shackleton, Exploring That Word, Leadership. Hey, Nancy.
Hey there.
Okay, Nancy. So tell those who didn't read it the story about the healthcare workers from the New York Times in Sierra Leone.
So on Sunday, two reporters, Adam Nossiter and Ben Solomon, just like it sounds, wrote a front-page story. It wasn't the lead story, but it's on the top of the fold on the left-hand side of the page, headlined, If They Survive the Ebola Ward, They Work On. And it's the story of nurses and some other healthcare workers, including a group of young men. This is all set in Sierra Leone, who bury Ebola corpses, right, which is very, very dangerous work. Huge amounts of the transmission of the disease
to date, a large number
have been infected by touching or getting close to corpses. So what these young men are doing, they call themselves the Burial Boys, is extremely important and also extremely dangerous. And the story is about how these people carry on and why they keep coming back to work. And there's a wonderful line in the story jumps to the inside of the A section, and it's a long story, and it's just extraordinarily well written. Where the writers describe, Nossiter and Solomon describe, the front lines against this disease are being stitched together by these people showing up every single day, often, you know, in danger for their lives. Some 10% of, as of about 4 days ago, these are the most recent WHO, World Health Organization statistics, about 10% of the 1,427 people that have been reported as dead of the Ebola virus, that's out of a total number of cases, dear readers, of 2,615, so roughly a fatality rate of 64%, about 10% of those 1,427 individuals were healthcare workers. So this work is extremely dangerous. The article goes on to talk not only about the danger, but about the extraordinary social stigma that each of these people faces, right? Nurses that go home and their spouses have packed their bags and left them on the curb and refused to let them back in their house, literally because these people are considered dangerous themselves, and they don't understand why they would possibly do this work. Villages that are ostracizing this young man they describe, who's in charge of helping bury bodies, that have ostracized him because he's considered a pariah, because he's involved not only in handling a dangerous disease, but involved in an entire set of operations and a disease that there are villages and groups of people in Western Africa that they don't recognize this as being legitimate, as being real. Some villages are still calling Ebola a hoax. So these workers are working against astounding odds every single day. And they focus their attention, the writers, on a nurse named Josephine Finda Selu.
How beautiful is the photograph of her?
And there's a huge picture of her on the front page, tearing up because she's describing the deaths of so many coworkers. And she says, you know, I wanted to give up, but I realized, you know, I can't give up. It's inevitable. I must keep doing this. This is healing. And it is important for me to do this. And, you know, and she takes all kinds of precautions. And she describes, she's been doing this since the outbreak really caught fire, really gathered momentum in March, April, and May of this year. And she describes how, you know, how she's seen these people come through, the nurses that have died from it, including a nurse who miscarried her baby. And then the four nurses that were helping in that delivery all got Ebola and died. I mean, it's extraordinary stories. And she says over and over again, but I must do this work. And as, you know, supplies come and processes get more institutionalized, she's noticed that things are becoming less chaotic. Because imagine, you're a nurse trying to stay safe, trying to help people, trying to do your work hour by hour that is truly your calling, and chaos reigns, social chaos, you know, supply chaos, practical chaos, emotional chaos, and you have very few processes. You have very few established regimes. The article describes all these nurses initially last spring trying to treat it like it was Lassa fever, another bleeding, what they call, I'll get this wrong, but basically a fever characterized by heavy bleeding. It has a much more technical term. And that proved inadequate because Lassa fever is much less contagious
yep.
than Ebola. So everywhere you look, these women, these burial boys, these young men, including the gentleman that they profile, who showed up and said, I had to do it, even though they wouldn't pay me. And, you know, he gets thrown out of his house and he begs for money for groceries,
for food.
Food money. He finally finds a place at the back of a store where he can sleep. And they start paying him $6 a day. And he says, I hope someday when this has subsided to come back to my village and the people will understand what I did because I'm doing this for our people. So my people will survive. So what strikes you when you reread the story is not only astounding obstacles, not only the courage, not only the steadfastness of these people, but the whole concept of what I call leadership with a small L, all of the unsung heroes every single day who show up to make an astounding difference that we almost never think about or hear about. Some of our listeners are indeed these heroes, but leadership comes in so many different shapes and sizes.
Stop there for a second.
And it's so important for us to recognize these people.
And we're talking to Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School. The next book you're working, it's not a secret. We talked about it. The next book you're working on is Leaders with a Capital L.
Yep.
But I want to talk about the small L as you talk about. We just left Charlie Sennett, who is spent much of his career in some of the most dangerous places on the planet. We talked to him about Theo Curtis, who was just released, Jim Foley, who obviously was executed. And Marjorie and I have talked off the air about how we would never put ourselves in those situations. Same with this nurse and this burial boy. What separates ordinary people, as I said before, who do extraordinary things? What causes ordinary people to become small L leaders when so many of the rest of us, in fact, probably the vast majority of us, would never do or have the courage to do what they do? What is the characteristic?
So it's a really important question, but I might just shake up the phrasing a little, Jim, because I think in many of these cases, these individuals, and you know, I've had cancer twice, as our listeners know, and I've met women like Josephine Fiendasello in chemo wards at Dana-Farber. I have met, you know, cops, right, who you know fit in exactly this kind of place. I've met librarians trying to keep their institutions open, volunteers trying to save animals, right, in a kind of catastrophe in Katrina.
People at the finish line on April 15th
on April
of a year ago.
On April 15th a year ago, at, you know, on Boylston Street. So I think it's less about characteristics and more about the inner power and spirit that lies within us, often dormant. And then something that calls it forth. So this woman who considered leaving, Josephine, who considered leaving, says, I cannot leave, right? Someone has to stop this. It's not going to be the WHO. It's not going to be the government of these nations, which as far as I can tell from the history of this, and I've read this very intently, followed this story very intently, the outbreak of the epidemic, and it's gathering steam. They basically shook their hands and sat on their fingers for months before they did anything, as has most of the West, because it's Africa, I think. And as Bono once said, history will judge us terribly for turning our backs, as the West has so often, on Africa.
By the way, I interviewed the wife of the who's a doctor from Nigeria, who is the former wife of the U.S. is the wife of the former ambassador to Nigeria. She totally agrees with you. It's because of the color of the skin of the vast majority of people who are suffering.
Absolutely.
From
But in any event, I think what we see here, and I think what we saw, and those people in the finish line, you know, those emergency workers who just dropped, you know, who pour into danger zones, is this the spirit that gets unlocked and that is incredibly powerful, that makes an enormous difference, in some sense, on an aggregate scale, much more difference than any of these huge, big leaders that we put up on pedestals. And yet, you know, many of us can go through our entire lives and never, right, put ourselves in a situation or turn into a situation, literally turn into a situation in which we will feel that power and have it unlocked, as indeed these people have. Because P.S., these people are not martyrs. They're not falling on their sword. They're doing something with great risk because they believe it is so important. And with that decision and with the daily work that they do grows extraordinary inner satisfaction, not to mention the satisfaction. They talk about this Josephine dancing a jig
when
her nurses survive Ebola, because people do survive, and not to mention the abiding external satisfaction of healing people and saving lives.
But Nancy Kane, this to me is very different. We all know firefighters run in when people run out, and cops with their life on the line, and people on the marathon, they didn't know if another bomb was going to go off or not. But to me, this is completely different, because those emergency workers are not going to lose their homes, and they're not going to lose their children. They're not going to lose their spouses. These are people, the burial boys particularly, who were not being paid until they got their $6 a day, had no place to live. These nurses, as you said at the beginning, were being thrown out of their homes. One of the women had the suitcases, her suitcases, all her belongings. So these people are giving up their homes, their children, their spouses, their families, everything, not to mention their lives, which is different than the firefighters.
I want to add something to this before you answer, because I think there's another element. I think you make a great point, but let me add to it. Forget the firefighters who are paid to do this, who've made a decision to do this. Talk about the Carlos Arredondos, who obviously we've known for years and years and became internationally famous with a cowboy hat when he rescued a young man who lost both his legs. As brilliant and courageous as that is, couldn't you convince yourself, Marjorie, that in the moment, you might have had the courage to do that? I might have been one of those people. I would never have been one of these people who would have made a conscious, thoughtful decision day after. That's exactly the distinction.
So one roughly comparable, or at least more closely comparable example to the firefighters and a response to your questions, Marjorie and Jim. I think it's a lot about a calling to a purpose you think is really important, right? So I'm a healer. She says at some point, you're a healer. She says it's God's work, but this article is not about her religious beliefs. That's the only time she mentions a higher power. I'm a healer. Right. So I think there's this idea of an inner worthy purpose is extraordinarily strong. There's a great article that I've talked about before. I just mentioned, I looked it up before I was coming in today, this commencement speech by David Foster Wallace, where he says at the very end of the speech, but of course, there are many, many different kinds of freedom. And the freedom you will not hear much talked about in the great outside world of winning, displaying, and achieving is a freedom that involves discipline and consistency and focus and attention and awareness, and is all about caring for people in a myriad of sexy, petty, small ways every single day. That is real freedom. So that is here, right? Part of what she is doing is about the freedom to answer the worthy higher purpose within. And let us not go lightly over the power of that. The second thing I promised, a comparable example. I was thinking as I walked into the studio today about Joshua Chamberlain. So your Civil War buffs will know exactly who I'm talking about in our listenership. He was a Bowdoin professor of rhetoric who, on July 2nd...
A Bowdoin professor of rhetoric?
Who became, one of the most important figures in the Civil War. So he and his group of Maine, I wish I could remember the troop number, but he and his group of Maine soldiers held off the Confederates on the second day of Gettysburg at a very important battle. Everyone that knows Civil War military history knows what I'm talking about, called Little Round Top. It was a defining moment. If the Confederates had taken this line, this small hillock, it would have changed Gettysburg. Well, Gettysburg was the denouement of the Civil War. So you drop the dominoes in your head and see what happens. But in any event, they run out of ammunition, and he forms this line of men locking arms with bayonets. And it's an astounding story. But here's the point. It wasn't just the moment, because all these guys sign up to go again, many of whom are injured. Chamberlain himself is injured a couple of times in the Civil War, and he keeps on coming back. Think, if that doesn't do it for you, because he was paid, think of the African-American soldiers who, once Lincoln allows them to fight, with a lot of urging from Frederick Douglass, go and fight and fight and fight again. Right, many of them for literally, pennies on the day. And so I think we have to go back to this idea of, what am I called to do? And if that calling is as strong as it is for Josephine Finda, or the young man who's keeping the groups of burial boys together, or that's their name, by the way, or Joshua Chamberlain's, soldiers from Maine, or those African-American soldiers who volunteered in 10 times the number relative to the population than white volunteers for the federal cause, then We are talking about the human spirit at its best, gassed, not in the moment, but by something that they regard from the inside out as something worth going into battle for every day.
Now, see, I thought that this was something maybe cultural with Sierra Leone because I get the nurses and I get the soldiers. The guys that were the janitors, which is not usually thought of as a calling, you know, to clean up right. after people. These are people who are cleaning up after Ebola victims. Would the same hold true with them?
Absolutely, because look at what he says. He says, I want someday to come back to my village when my people have survived and for them to understand why I did this. I did this for the survival of my people. Talk about honor. Right?
Yeah.
H-O-N-O-U-R, because the British and English understand the importance of this word. We in America don't pause to think about what honor really means. That is honor. That is Wallace's freedom. That is the real deal. And by the way, he keeps on doing it. So I often say to my students, this course, this history I teach, this course about the history of leadership, which has small L leaders in it, I often say, A lot of what leaders do, people like Josephine, is get right with themselves over and over and over again. So every single morning, she gets right with herself by pulling on her scrubs, then walking to that hospital or however she gets there and putting on her suit, right? All these different protective layers she has to wear. And that is so important. But imagine from the inside out, you are right with yourself about doing something that really makes a difference. It kind of puts a lot of other stuff in perspective.
Okay, so Nancy Kane, you talked a minute ago in your class. We're talking to Harvard, Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School. We only have a couple of minutes left. You talked about teaching the history of leadership, capital L and lowercase l. What you also do is you coach capital L leaders to be better leaders. Could you coach people who want to be Marjorie and me, and I don't mean this facetiously, I want to be like that woman, or at least more like that woman than I currently am, or more like the burial boy than I am. Could you get me, the generic me and me, in a session and cause me to connect to the things that exist?
I would try. I would certainly try.
How would you do that?
We'd start by talking about something that really was very important to you in a specific setting. We'd probably start with something that didn't have anything to do with you, a case, an individual, and then we'd talk about, right, you know, talk about what's the higher road knot in your path right now. You want to be on the higher road. What's the knot or the tree or the flat tire that's in front of you that's keeping you from that? And we would work through it. The most satisfying work I have done all these years is with these executives. We're often working on something that's very related to their business, but it turns out because it's all one big Coco Vaughn. It's not business and life. It's all one big stew. The most satisfying work I do and the work that people send me cards about, right, or call me about or email me about years later, is about some kind of tree that our work together helped them saw through so they could get on that high road.
In
their own lives.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a game.
You know, by the way, you know, the amazing part of this is, believe me, I am not equating what we read about in the New York Times and you're describing, obviously, in some of these horrific Ebola settings. But when you do see these moments, I was mentioning to Marjorie, one of the most moving stories I read in the Boston Globe Sunday magazine years ago was about nurses in pediatric oncology wards. I mean, dealing with little children who, innocent little kids who are suffering these horrible things. But it's not just in life and death situations. We talk nonstop about the market basket people, 49 years, started at 14 years old, and worked their whole lives, who are putting their families and themselves at risk for a greater good, at least in their estimation. It is amazing.
It is. And you know, just as a last comment, imagine, you know, think about Kant's categorical imperative, right? Act only on the things that you are prepared to
think about it all the time.
To see generalizable. But to apply that here, imagine if each of us could unlock that power it is within, or if we could go back to the moments when we felt it. Imagine how different the world would be.
Okay,
before
Jim,
we go, we have 30 seconds. What's our favorite example in the United States, Marjorie, we talk about all the time that we wouldn't have had the courage to do?
Well, the guy on the subway?
Subway in New York City.
Yeah, when he
jumps on the subway, puts his body over a guy who had fallen on the tracks under a subway car, and they both survived.
Okay.
Nancy, it's great to see you.
We won't be doing that anytime soon,
no,
Jim.
We will not.
Nancy Kane is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robertson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Nancy, kind of inspirational today to talk to you.
Indeed.
And great as always. Up next, the winners and losers of the small screen. TV guru Bob Thompson joins us for a review of last night's Emmys. Stay tuned for that at 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Last night's Emmys delivered big wins, as you probably know, for Breaking Bad and Modern Family. Though Mad Men and House of Cards failed to score awards, could the biggest loser of the evening have been the Emmy ceremony itself for serving up a three-hour spread of corn and ham? Joining us online for a recap of last night and the future next year of television is Bob Thompson. He's the founding director of the Bleier Center for TV and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of TV and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. Hello there, Bob.
Hey, how are you?
Excellent, thanks.
Hey, Bob, thank you for joining us. So, Bob, should that be the headline, 3 hours of corn and ham? I mean, is Jim right about that?
I'm still contemplating some brilliant thing that Sarah Silverman said, and I'm going to try to learn needlepoint so I can put this into a little sampler and hang it over my bed. And what she said was, "We are all just made of molecules and hurtling through space right now."
You know, can I
tell me, I'll sit through 3 hours to hear Sarah Silverman say something as profound as that.
You know, Bob, I have to say, it's almost embarrassing, but I was thinking of you during all 3 hours of my viewing last night. No, I really was. And we've spent a year talking to you about how cutting edge television has been over the last year. Historically cutting edge, I would argue. And that was the least cutting edge, most 1980s-ish kind of dull television with huge stars one could possibly imagine. Did I miss something?
Well, no, you didn't. But I think that is a property of a lot of these award shows, not so much the Golden Globes, not so much the VMAs, but the Oscars and the Emmys, the old legacy award shows. You get these people together and you've got some of the most brilliant actors alive, and you give them these lines like, "If it's not on the page, it's not on the stage." The writer contributes. I mean, it sounds like, as you say, it sounds like this could have been Emmy night 1959. And I think part of it is the format only lets you do so many things. You've got to name the nominees, you've got to bring them up, and they've got to make their speeches. And I would say the most cutting-edge thing about the 2014 Emmy program was that it ended right on time.
Yeah, and pathetically.
It was over by 11 o'clock.
Yeah, but, and it ended right on time by rushing Vince Gilligan of the great Breaking Bad, which we'll get to in a minute, and then having Seth Meyers say, "We got to go, good night, thanks for being here."
You know, right, the best way to... the less of Vince Gilligan you hear, the better. Because you know how, and I know you and I agree about Breaking Bad as being
yes,
one of the
do.
Great human creations of all time.
Yes.
And whenever, sometimes you shouldn't listen or you shouldn't meet the artists that make great art that you admire. Because the longer I hear Vince Gilligan talk, the more I think, wow, did he really make Breaking Bad?
Well, you know, speaking of that, by the way, since you said that, I was going to get to this in a few minutes, but here's Aaron Paul, also known as Jesse Pinkman, giving his acceptance speech for a supporting actor. Listen to what Aaron Paul has to say.
Oh, wow. I feel like I'm going to throw up. My God, Breaking Bad. It has changed my life, and I'm standing up here because of one man, and that is Vince Gilligan. Thank you so much, Vince.
My younger daughter said when she's watching him, she said, "I'm so upset. He's not acting. He is Jesse Pinkman." I mean, sometimes you don't want to know who these people are.
When he said, "I think I'm going to throw up," I think he was speaking for many of the people in the audience.
Well, let's get on to some other bad performances. We have a whole kind of montage of bad performances, do we not? Do we identify these first, this montage of people? We have Weird Al doing Mad Men, Colbert and his imaginary friend Roscoe, and then, of course, the host of the evening, Seth Meyers. Let's take a listen.
Mad Men, Mad Men, watch these ad men do they're thinking while they're stinking drunk.
Well, the Academy has once again overlooked who I believe is the greatest supporting actor of his generation. I'm talking, of course, about my imaginary friend, Roscoe.
NBC also decided to hold the Emmys a month earlier in August to avoid conflicting with Sunday Night Football, which is keeping with the actor's tradition of running away from jocks.
Now, of those were my highlights or the lowlights, and we're going to get to good news in a minute of the three worst things that we had to see last night. Weird Al, forget about, because he is weird. Seth Meyers, to me, is again, of another generation, even though he's of this generation. The thing that was troubling to me, is this a taste of what Stephen Colbert, as Stephen Colbert, is going to be like when he's playing himself?
Well, I'm afraid it might be. And I think you're right to be worried. First of all, the Weird Al thing, I remember when Bill Murray put lyrics to the theme song from Star Wars, and it was about the funniest thing I ever heard. But that was about 35 years ago. And when Weird Al does it in 2014, it just didn't seem as funny anymore. As for Colbert, I think we've already had a little taste of that. When Letterman had Colbert on his show after the big announcement had been made, maybe a week later or so, we saw Colbert being Colbert as opposed to being that Bill O'Reilly type of character. And I have to say, and I think you and I might have talked about this, it didn't look nearly as funny or as interesting as he is. So I think there may be some rough going for him in the beginning and maybe all through that job. However, you didn't include it in there the one that I thought was the weirdest, and some people are calling it offensive, and that's when the president of the Academy gets up to explain his boring stuff. And they put Sofia Vergara up on a pedestal, literally up on a pedestal, that rotates. And she's in a gown that accentuates her sumptuous body. And that was really, really weird. Here's this white guy suit, president of the Academy, putting this beautiful woman up and having her rotate so we can, I guess, ogle her.
Well, that was exactly. I plead guilty. It should have been on my list.
Bob Thompson, before we get too far from Colbert, you know, why can't Colbert just continue to be his character? Why does he have to change? I mean, why can't he continue? He's been doing interviews on his show. You know, do something different in late night TV. Don't be who you are.
Well, I suppose that's something that they considered, and I don't know what the intellectual property issues would be, but he's doing a show that's clearly a parody program of a certain kind of cable news show. And when he moves over to network and, for one thing, is going an hour instead of a half an hour, and he's bringing in a bunch of different guests, whenever he does the interviews, his character sometimes ends up leaving a little bit anyway. So I think it'd be hard to pull off. The other thing is I think Colbert realizes that character may be reaching a period where it's beginning to get to the end of its shelf life. And if he thinks that, I think he might be right.
Well, speaking of end of a shelf life, and it's sad for all of us, Bryan Cranston, at least this shelf life, as Walter White. I was making fun of Jesse Pinkman, Aaron Paul before. Here is Bryan Cranston dedicating his Emmy to people who are trying to coast through life. Listen.
I was a kid who always looked for the shortcut, schemer. My own family nicknamed me Sneaky Pete. I'd like to dedicate this award to all the Sneaky Petes of the world who thought that maybe settling for mediocrity was a good idea because it was safe. Don't do it. Take a chance. Take a risk. Find that passion. Rekindle it. Fall in love all over again.
That
was terrific.
It was beautiful. He was great the whole night. The 11 or 12 second kiss of Julia Louis-Dreyfus. What is next for him? I saw him, and I may have mentioned this to you, Bob, in all the way that when he does LBJ and this great thing about LBJ in the middle of the civil rights struggle, it's going to come to HBO. It obviously is on Broadway, too. What does he do next after this iconic role that'll never be forgotten? What does he do?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be hard to escape the gravitational pull of Walter White because the escape velocity that will be required is going to be extraordinary. But I think he's the kind of actor that will be able to do that. For one thing, he's got a generic enough body and face. I mean,
yes.
Hamm looks like John Hamm. It hits you right in the over the head. Gandolfini, you know, you looked like you knew exactly who he was.
Yeah.
This guy, he can kind of be on Malcolm in the Middle, and then he can be on Breaking Bad. I think he's a much more chameleon-like physical presence. But can I go back to that speech? Because I agree.
Sure.
I think that was a beautiful speech, but it's even more eerie when you kind of speculate that, okay, that same speech could have been delivered by Walter White, because Walter White was bored. He was teaching chemistry to a bunch of uninspired high school teachers, and he found his passion. Walter White was Sneaky Pete when he was a good guy. And in that final episode, when he finally has to explain to his wife why he did this, and he said, because I was good at it. It's exactly, Bryan Cranston and Walter White could have both delivered that speech, one with really good results, one with results which were not so good.
Yeah, let's hope the kids don't take that message home. If things don't go well, start a meth lab in the basement. What the heck? But you mentioned,
but it was about the passion.
Yeah,
and
no, you're right.
The whole
you're
ending
right.
of Mad Men was that Walter White really found his
Breaking
passion.
Bad.
Remember on that first pilot episode, after he had the thrill of doing something he was so great at, he went back to his wife and in the bedroom, and she goes, "You know, what's gotten into you? Where did that come from?"
Okay, you mentioned John Hamm and how he looks like John Hamm, and he does. I saw him in the picture of some magazine recently. I couldn't believe it, the cover photograph.
How much he looks like John Hamm.
Well, it's just like, you know, it's like Tom Brady. I mean, sometimes the mold is broken, you know, and we create these absolutely gorgeous-looking people. But anyway, he's been nominated, what is it, 12 times? And never won. So what's that about?
Well, ask Susan Lucci. She'd be better able to answer
the
question, although she finally got to win.
Yeah, she was from the soap opera,
they're
going
to get one more chance, aren't they?
Yeah, but that's when he gets his lifetime achievement for Mad Men. Does he not, after the second half season of his final season?
And will the second half season, though, be in the 2015 Emmys? I think it might be.
You're the expert.
I don't know.
I hope so.
Yeah,
I
should
think
have looked
so,
that
yeah.
up before you called. But anyway, so it is one of those situations that every now and again, you know, you've got these great great actors that for one reason or another, and this happens true, Scorsese was another one who, for whatever reason, kind of don't get Oscars that or Emmys that everybody thinks they should. By the way, can I say, we were talking about Colbert. I remember one thing. When Colbert was speaking through Fallon, whatever that was all about, and it's like Fallon, the Beatles, all four of them could get back together. Two could come back to life, and if Fallon had anything to do with it, he'd be the fifth one singing on stage. But there was one great line, which is, I think, the perfect theory for every Emmy speech from now on, and he's speaking through Fallon, which is said, thanks to everybody, you know who you are. If you don't, look it up on IMDb. It's really
great.
Comprehensive.
That was great.
That was a real, I mean, that could be every Emmy speech.
We're talking with Bob Thompson from the Blair Center for TV and Popular Culture at Syracuse University. Bob, you know, we all have been ranting and raving about how wonderful we've been raving, not ranting, about how wonderful Netflix is. Everybody's big into House of Cards, of course, and Orange is the New Black. Neither of them did very well last night. Orange is the New Black was kind of weirdly entered in the comedy section, which seemed odd.
Right, and what's his name? Seth Meyers made a joke about this right at the top.
Yes.
There was a number, and the Emmys are going to have to fix this because it's going to be hard because I think calling things dramas and comedies has not made sense in some ways since the 80s, and it certainly doesn't make much sense now. But you're right. Fargo is called a miniseries. Okay, it should be. But then True Detective is called the drama series. It's every bit as much a miniseries as Fargo was. William H. Macy, who I think did an incredible job in Shameless, is an actor in a comedy, which doesn't make sense. And then, of course, you point out Game of Thrones was nominated in comedy because they didn't want to have to compete with the juggernauts in that category, including Breaking Bad, which won. So that's one thing it's going to have to get is going to have to get fixed. I was surprised too, though. All the Netflix Emmys that they got weren't given on Emmy night. They were given a week before in those creative arts things, which is kind of the second tier stuff. And I thought the industry was really going to be on this bandwagon of the new media and everybody's so excited about all of these new delivery systems. But this year, they went in the other direction. The statistic that most astounds me about this year's Emmys is that for all the talk that all the quality is on cable, indeed, the number one winner was HBO with 19, But the next four slots, 2, 3, 4, and 5, go to none other than broadcast networks. CBS and PBS got 11 each, NBC got 10, and ABC got 8.
You know, you mentioned a minute ago the odd positioning of shows. For example, Fargo and True Detective, both of which I thought were brilliant. Fargo, of course, is a miniseries for, I said, of course, why? Who knows? True Detective is a drama. Marjorie, ask the question you asked me this morning about those two great shows in the future. It was a good one.
They're supposedly going on to a second season, but William Macy and Billy Bob Thornton, whatever his name is, that were the
Not
stars.
Not Macy, Martin Freeman.
That were the stars of Fargo and the True Detective guys, Harrelson and McConaughey, they're not going to be back. So I'm not clear how do you go to a second season without the main characters?
It's not only just not the main characters. In many cases, it's going to be in these new kinds of shows completely different settings and everything else. True Detective, by all rumors, are going to not only be a whole new batch of actors, it's going to take place in California. And I think this is actually a perfectly good idea. We used to have the anthology dramas where every week there'd be a completely self-contained play. These are a little different where you've got one title. So you've got a certain artist who's involved with it, a showrunner, and all these kinds of things. But they can tell a story. It can have a beginning, a middle, and end. It doesn't have to be like a series which goes on forever. It can be self-contained. They do 8 episodes. And then under the same title, which has now got some brand recognition and all the rest of it, they do 8 more. And it could take place on the moon with completely different characters. And I think that opens up some really wonderful aesthetic space. True Detective, you just do detective stories. I'm not sure what Fargo is going to do in its second season. That seems a little bit tougher, even though where the series takes place, there are scenes in Fargo, but it actually takes place in Bemidji, Minnesota.
You know, speaking of those two shows, which are probably, with House of Cards, my 3 favorites of the year, Matthew McConaughey was the most talked about person last night, nonstop. I thought the funniest thing about him, Jimmy Kimmel takes to the stage, and before he presents whatever award he's presenting, he starts talking to and about McConaughey. Here it
is. Ruthlessly.
Here it is.
You were great in True Detective. You may well be the best actor, but you just won the Oscar like 5 months ago. It's no offense, but how many of those speeches of yours are we supposed to sit through? I mean, all right already.
So
that was great.
What's that? I mean,
he later asked him if he was expecting to get the BET Award.
That was great. And by the way, there was a great line when in the great acceptance speech that we played part of a couple of minutes ago from Bryan Cranston for Best Actor in a Drama, he starts by saying something like, he looks at McConaughey and he says, you know, I was thinking of voting for Matthew, too, who was nominated in the same category. Did he not get it just because Bryan Cranston was better or because there was weariness of the McConaughey thing? Obviously, he's had a year like no other.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, when you look at that category, it was an unbelievable category. Cranston and Breaking Bad, John Hamm and Mad Men, who hadn't gotten it before, Harrelson and McConaughey, Spacey and House of Cards, who I kind of thought might sneak in there.
So did I.
And even Jeff Daniels. I know Newsroom is not a loved series, but Jeff Daniels, I think, did an extraordinary job in that. So who knows what elements went into. In some ways, I thought this season might be the one that Breaking Bad had already gotten so much love that maybe that was going to begin to shift to other things. I was wrong. Breaking Bad did very well, I think, and I think you agree with me that it deserved to get it for this last batch of episodes. Whether the other was McConaughey fatigue or whether or not people just looked at Cranston's performance and thought that this could be very close to the greatest single performance that ever happened in the history of American television, and as good as McConaughey was and as good as Kevin Spacey was, 100 years from now, I think when you look at Breaking Bad and True Detective and House of Cards, Breaking Bad is going to be one of the TV masterpieces.
You know, I love that. One of the things I love about you, Bob Thompson, is you never shy away from hyperbole. I mean, I mean that in the most loving sort of way. One last thing from me.
Occasionally, 50 years.
We occasionally get email from people after it says, why don't you talk about shows that you're not interested in that everybody else is? Game of Thrones is probably a pretty good example. But a show that did very well last night that I have never seen won an award for Jessica Lange. as Best Actress. Kathy Bates, the great Kathy Bates. I don't even know what she won for, Best Guest Appearance or some such thing. American Horror Story. What is this show?
Oh, this is another, and this is sort of halfway between these anthologies we were talking about before. It's and it gets put in the miniseries category, which is where it belongs, even though it also then doesn't have to compete with these other things. Each season, they have a it starts all over, so it gets completely reset each season with some overlap in the cast and some new cast. But the settings and the premises and the characters are all different. So I think the upcoming season is going to take place in a carnival, which, as a former Ferris wheel operator, I can't wait to see, because carnivals can be American Horror Stories, as Stephen King and Ray Bradbury have already told us. This last one that the awards was for was in a witch's coven. It was called Coven. So it's this odd admixture of anthology series like True Detective and regular series, so there's continuity of title, continuity of some actors, but otherwise they get to change it completely. And you know, it's not like when the Ten Commandments were dictated, it was stated that something has to be, you know, a drama has to go with the same characters all the time, and it's got to be an hour long and whatever. I really like the idea that the last five or so years we're beginning to explore the fact that you can do other things with television than the way we've been doing it since the age of radio gave way.
You know, speaking of 5 years, let me end at least my part of this with what I thought was the cutest acceptance speech. I don't know if that's a kind word to use. Modern Family won his best comedy for the fifth year in a row. And executive producer Steve Levitan, I think his name is, tells a story about bringing his then 10-year-old daughter to a totally unproductive Modern Family story meeting. Listen to this.
She sat with a room full of writers, watching them think, talk, share anecdotes, watch YouTube videos, anything to spark an idea. And 8 long hours later, we had absolutely nothing. We went home and I was a little bit embarrassed. And then she looked up at me in these big eyes and she said, "Thanks for taking me to work with you, Daddy. I really loved it so much. I learned what you did and it makes me so proud." And then she turned into the kitchen and said to my wife, "It's a wonder we have a roof over our heads."
That was pretty great. No, Bob?
That was great.
It was great. And, you know, there are so few great sitcoms, half-hour sitcoms, that will be syndicatable forever. And those that there are, Big Bang, Two and a Half Men, and certainly Modern Family, in the end are the most valuable commodities on Earth, practically. So not only does that kid going to have a roof over her head, but Levitan is making money with that shows that will put roofs over the heads of 7 generations of Levitan.
So Bob Thompson, before you go, anything you've seen that's exciting coming up in this fall?
Well, I think there's lots of stuff, and some of it we've already gotten a head start on. The second season of Masters of Sex on Showtime is one of the most peculiar programs, and it's doing some really, really interesting things. I have to say, it's not one of those shows I really enjoy watching. Sometimes a couple episodes will stack up in my DVR queue, but every time I watch it, it's like reading James Joyce. It's not really any fun, but it certainly is intellectually mind-boggling.
How about the flip side? Some things that are really hype big time for the fall that you've seen or at least heard a lot about that aren't going to quite make it, that we shouldn't spend our binge watching
time
viewing.
Yeah, well, I haven't seen a lot of it, so I think a lot of stuff won't. There's this one called Selfie, which has already been put on the you can see it on the internet, like Glee, they put on way back in the spring, the first season that came out. And this is supposed to be, the title itself, you know, is it's going to be all about, it's retelling the My Fair Lady story, but in the social media age. And I swear there must have been 70 hashtag social media kinds of jokes that might have been funny 4 years ago, but that now just seem like, already so incredibly old. The genre to pay attention to, though, is the emerging genre of naked TV, dating naked, buying naked, naked and afraid. This is taking over the periphery of our culture in some ways that we really need to pay attention to.
Oh, my goodness.
Speak for yourself. Have you been
to a naked beach or two? I don't think we want to see the same thing. Yes, and it's always a big disappointment. Everybody in the naked beach are the people that shouldn't be on the naked beach, if you know what I mean.
You have not seen disappointment.
Okay, all right. Then I'll check that out.
Bob Thompson,
thank you for being
with
us, as always. Bob Thompson is the founding director of the Blyer Center for Television and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of TV and popular culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Please tune in tomorrow. We'll be joined by Juliet Kyan for Open Mic. Our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan, will talk to him about Ebola and some other things. Our show is a production of WGBH. Our production team, Chelsea Mers, Will Roslip, Amanda McGowan, our engineers, John Parker and Alan Mattis. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I'm Jim Browdy.
Thanks for listening, and please listen again tomorrow. Bye.